Welcome to the Litigation War Room, where you will hear great stories and great insights from some of the nation's most accomplished courtroom lawyers. Here is your host, litigation attorney Maxwell Goss.
On this episode, I talk with high-stakes family law attorney Ashish Joshi. Ashish handles disputes involving the mistreatment of children, allegations of child abuse, and recovery of abducted children across the United States and around the world. An authority on the subject of parental alienation, Ashish is the author of Litigating Parental Alienation, Evaluating and Presenting an Effective Case in Court. In the interview, Ashish offers insights drawing from his deep knowledge and experience in this important area of law. The Litigation War Room is a proud sponsor of the State Bar of Michigan's Business Law Symposium on January 20th, 2022. After my interview with Ashish Joshi, stay tuned for my chat with powerhouse litigator Powell Miller of the Miller Law Firm, who will give us a preview of his upcoming presentation at the Business Law Symposium. Ashish Joshi, welcome to the Litigation War Room.
Thank you, Max. Pleasure to be here with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm excited to hear about your practice, your family law practice. I know you do high stakes family law litigation and have a particular focus on what are called parental alienation cases, and actually have a new book out about litigating parental alienation cases. And it's a very exciting and interesting and important topic, and look forward to learning more about that. But before we dig in to that topic, could you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and about your firm?
Sure. Well, I'm based out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. I live in Ann Arbor. My practice focuses on 100-person litigation cases. I litigate cases involving complex family law issues, more particularly related to child alienation, parental alienation, child abuse. Unfortunately, sometimes cases involving child homicide as well. I also do criminal defense in these cases as well. So sometimes I would represent a parent or a teacher who is accused of child abuse in a court of law, where they're defending against felony charges. I also do cases involving international child abduction, where someone has taken a kid away to a Hague or a non-Hague country. What's somewhat unique about my practice is that family law is generally state-focused. So you would often find lawyers focusing on one particular state, if not a county. But my practice has taken me all over America, all over family courts around the country and internationally as well. And that just happened to be. I didn't start out that way, but that's what my practice is as of now.
Well, that's very interesting. So you're a family lawyer, but not your run-of-the-mill family lawyer. These international, you've got all these interesting components, international law and criminal defense and everything else that all arise out of it. Has it always had a national profile, or did you start more locally?
I started out locally, but I always had an international background. So I was born and grew up in India. I went to first law school in India. I practiced law for about 5 years in India before I came for my master's to the U.S. And in America, I came to the University of Michigan Law School, where I focused mainly on litigation courses, international courses. And upon graduation from the law school, I took the New York and Michigan bars. I do a fair amount of cross-border cases, India, U.S., family and civil cases as well. But it started off local, mainly in New York and Michigan. And as I did more of these cases, I would get calls from people who knew my clients or lawyers from other part of the state who either read something that I wrote or were in the audience of one of my CLE presentations or other presentations, and would invite me to join the team as co-counsel, counsel pro hac vice, and that's how the practice began.
I just have to ask, because it's not every day that I interview a lawyer who has practiced in both India and the United States. How would you compare the practice of law in those two jurisdictions in your experience?
Well, both systems are based out of the British common law, mainly the Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence. India, one of the remarkable things or differences is that despite having a robust British tradition in the legal area, India does not have jury trials. So there are only bench trials in every case, family, criminal, civil, commercial, whatever you have. So that's something different. The substantive laws, laws relating to contracts, property, evidence, criminal defense, there's not that much of difference. It's remarkably similar because as it goes back to the old British common law. In terms of procedure, apart from the jury trials, there are a lot of differences which would be too technical for our discussion today. But one of the things about Indian litigation area is that it's just tremendous. There's tremendous backlog.
A lot of American litigators, I think, would say there's a tremendous backlog here, but I take it there's a bit more of one in India.
Absolutely. I mean, when you compare that to the backlog in India, it pales in comparison. You know, I'll share a story with you. So we were visiting Indian Supreme Court, and we were meeting with the Indian Supreme Court justices. This was back in 2017 or 18. And I was there with the president of the American Bar Association, the chair of the section of litigation, the vice chair of section of litigation, and we were taken to observe some of the oral arguments. And after sitting there for about 35, 45 minutes, one of the members of our team inquired as to how long do the oral arguments go and how long this is going to go on. It was a cross-border river dispute between the two states, I remember. And I just chuckled and waited for the gentleman who was our guide to explain it to them. And he said, rightfully so, there is no limit. There is no limit on oral arguments. An oral argument could take 1 hour, 2 hours, or 10 days. And that was just shocking to our American lawyers.
Sounds like a cricket match.
Indeed. So when we met the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the Associate Justices for tea later on, they inquired about it and asked, why wouldn't you put limits on oral arguments, particularly when you're dealing with such a backlog? And the Chief Justice seemed to be taken aback a little bit by that and said, well, that would be so rude. It would be just remarkably rude and disrespectful because this is the highest court in the land. And we want people to understand and feel that they've had their say. So we try to streamline it, but ultimately we don't shut them down. This is the people's court and they are here to have their say. So it's a very different perception, culture, call you what, but so those are some of the differences.
Okay, wow. Well, that's very interesting. Well, we're starting to digress. I think that could probably be a whole podcast interview in itself, but thanks for sharing a bit of your perspective on that. I do want to turn to your book. You're a very prolific writer, and I know you've written quite a bit on parental alienation in particular, but I want to talk about your book, which I understand is out just this year. It's an ABA book called Litigating Parental Alienation, Evaluating and Presenting an Effective Case in Court. Could you just tell us what prompted you to write this book?
Well, I have been writing on the topic of parental alienation for quite some time, for over a decade now. And in 2020, I contributed a chapter to the book called Parental Alienation, Science and Law. And my chapter focused on international issues on parental alienation. How does the rest of the world view parental alienation? So it was a survey of common law systems such as the US, Canada, Australia, the UK, India, and others, and the civil law systems as well, Germany, France, Scandinavian countries, and their take on alienation, how they view it, how do they acknowledge it, what sort of interventions they provide and whatnot. And in doing the research for that chapter, I came across many, many cases in America as well. A lot of misinformation out there. And drawing on my own experiences, I thought it would be a good text for family law attorneys and people, to parents who find themselves in family courts, as somewhat of a blend of a how-to book together with some substantive law in it. And that's why I decided to write it.
Well, let's do a little level setting here. Parental alienation is a phrase that is probably familiar to some listeners, but is probably unfamiliar to others. You and I were chatting before this podcast, and I mentioned that you had asked me what parental alienation was before, you know, I perused your book and did some of my diligence for this interview. I would have had very little to say on the topic. I don't really do family law. So could you just give our listeners an explanation of what is parental alienation?
Parental alienation is a state. It's a mental state in the child where a child rejects a parent or resists having a relationship with the parent for no justifiable or no legitimate reason. Typically, it involves manipulation, brainwashing, programming, interference, call it what you will, by the favored parent and the favored parent's allies or enablers. Could be family members, could be school teachers, could be friends, families. But because of that undue influence and alienating behaviors, the child starts rejecting the targeted parent. So that's parental alienation. And the important thing to note about that is that we don't simply assume that because the child is rejecting a parent, there must be alienation. A lot of detractors out there try to attack the theory by saying that, oh, the theory of parental alienation simply assumes that the child has been manipulated or coached or brainwashed. No, we don't do that. It's only based upon certain evidence that you look at and then you try to get to the bottom of, and you realize that this particular child has been alienated against the other parent. And the key element of any alienation case is that the rejection by the child or the resistance to the relationship by the child is always disproportionate to anything that the parent is alleged to have done.
When you say alleged to have done, you're talking about situations of abuse or neglect or allegations of these things?
Yeah, let me give you a few scenarios. So a typical case of parental alienation would look like the couple goes through a divorce. Let's suppose in the example that the father is the alienating parent and the mother is the targeted parent. So let's suppose we have a son of that couple, 10 years old, and the mother starts noticing that the son is rude, defiant, refuses to come over for visitation, says things which are absolutely not true and strange, such as you left us, you abandoned dad and us, you were never around while I was growing up, you are not a mom. Mother's name is, let's say, Sandy. I'm going to call you Sandy. You're not my mom. You don't know what a true mother means or looks like. You are an alcoholic. You are all about, it's all about money for you, career, whatnot. And when we look at the evidence, the baseline relationship that the mother enjoyed with the child, she was an involved parent. Yes, she worked outside of home, as did the father. She was an involved parent. She went to the school parent-teacher meetings. She was at the birthday parties, on vacations, very much involved with the child's life. And all of a sudden, there's a new reality here where the child starts parroting what the dad has been saying. Then mom was an alcoholic. She was a party goer. She had an affair and whatnot. And when the child is asked for specific examples, well, you call your mom abusive. Tell me what did your mom do? They don't have examples. It's not a case where the mother was physically abusive, beat the crap out of the kid, was engaged in corporal punishment, was neglectful parent, had abandoned the kid, never showed up for any of the birthdays or anything of that nature. These cases are distinguishable, and there's a particular way to litigate a case involving parental alienation. We can talk about that later. But that's what you look for. And you have to resist your intuition. Many family lawyers go with the intuition saying, well, the kid's 10, 12, it's not going to help if we force visitation. Let's go for therapy. Let's have some quote-unquote cooling off period. Don't force the kid to see the mother and maybe the kid's going to settle down. And it doesn't happen. It doesn't help. It makes alienation far worse. It poisons the whole atmosphere. The kid continues to hear the same toxic message from the alienating parent. And then you also look at the alienating parent, the favored parent. You just don't focus on the child and the child's symptoms or signs. You also look at what the other parent is doing. Is the favored parent fanning the flames here? Is their favored parent carrying on a campaign of denigration? You know, I've had cases where the favored parent allowed the child to read some totally inappropriate things. Litigation filings, for example. Pictures or text messages between the other parent and their significant other. Or if one parent had an affair outside the marriage, the favored parent shared all those scandalous details with the child, totally inappropriate. And when they're confronted about it, the answer is, well, I'm not going to lie to my son. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm going to tell it like it is. So there is that boundary violation. They forget that the child is a child and adults are adults. And the healthy boundaries which should remain between the parents and the children are often violated. And you see some sort of enmeshment going on where the child is brought in as an ally. It's us versus her. It's us versus the judge. It's us versus the entire world. And then enmeshment slowly and gradually can turn pathological, where all boundaries are erased, and the kid and the favored parent sometimes dress alike. They complete the sentences for each other. Sometimes you also see them sleeping in the same bed, even though the kid's 12, 13, 14 years old. Texting each other constantly, not having any other social peers. And that dynamic needs to be explored, and you need to do something about it because there are significant long-term and short-term consequences of alienation that a child can go through.
Reading your book, you characterize this as a form of child abuse. This isn't just simply an attitude or a problem a child has, but is the result of abusive conduct on the part of the alienating parent. Is that right?
That's right. Alienation is a spectrum. So you can have cases of mild alienation, moderate alienation, and all the way to severe parental alienation. And severe parental alienation has been categorized by courts and in research as child maltreatment and child psychological abuse. There have been decisions from the courts which have called alienation as emotional abuse of a child. And you do see some significantly concerning behaviors from alienated children. I mean, these kids literally freak out when they see the targeted parent or disfavored parent. They yell, they scream, sometimes they are physically violent. Police are called at the custody exchanges, you know, exchanging the kid. And after alienation sets in, the favored parent sometimes simply take the step back and say, oh, it's not me, it's the kid. I mean, I don't want to force the child to see the mother. I'm all for the child having a relationship with the mother, but it should be healthy. I'm not doing anything here. So it's very duplicitous if you go down. And when you see that at every turn, when the favored parent was given an opportunity to facilitate and encourage the relationship, they didn't do that. There was a case out of Tennessee, going by the anecdote that I was sharing with you, the father being the alienator. It was McLean versus McLean, I think 2018 Court of Appeals opinion. And the Court of Appeals found that the father had engaged in horrific duplicitous behavior and had alienated the son from the mother. The father used biblical quotes, called the mother pure evil, told the son that she doesn't love you, no one can possibly like your mother. And despite the trial court's repeated interference, just kept on alienating. And when asked about it and when confronted, put it all on the son. It's not me, it's him. He doesn't like his mother. I can't do anything about it. And finally, the Court of Appeals stepped in and put in some really strong intervention in place, saying that enough already. We have spent so many years going from one therapist to another therapist, having one guardian ad litem to another guardian ad litem in the case. And it's clear as a day to us that unless and until the child is removed from that toxic environment, nothing is going to change. And that's what's important, Max, that in cases involving alienation, time is the enemy. Because many, many judges will simply throw their hands up, even when confronted with the evidence of alienation, if the kid's 14, 15, 16-year-old. Because they seem to believe, wrongly in my opinion, that you can't really do anything about adolescents. If the child's 15 or 16 year old, you can't really force them to go with the other parent. And that's wrong, by the way. Courts have done that. And the children have shown tremendous amount of resilience when given proper remedial measures. But that's a main issue. So you need to rush to the court. You need to get an evidentiary hearing. You need to understand that traditional therapy is not going to work in cases of alienation. It's only going to make it far worse. And you need to do some due diligence before agreeing to a guardian ad litem being appointed or a minor's counsel being appointed. Because a bad or incompetent guardian ad litem could do far more damage to the case than not having a guardian ad litem in the case.
Just shed a little more light on that, if you could. How does a guardian ad litem usually get involved in these cases in the first place?
Guardian ad litem is a unique role in the family law arena. And different jurisdictions have different terms for that. So in some jurisdictions, they call them CLR, which is Child's Legal Representative. In some jurisdictions, they're minors' counsel. Other jurisdictions, they're guardians ad litem. And they don't have to be attorneys. Many jurisdictions, for example, Michigan, allows a non-lawyer GL to be on the case. You could be a mental health expert. You could be a psychologist, a social worker, and function as a GL. Other jurisdictions, for example, Massachusetts, have two categories of guardians ad litem, a mental health expert and a legal professional. And depending on the facts of the case, a court could appoint a psychologist as a GL or an attorney as a GL. But essentially, a GL is a court-appointed official who is usually tasked with the job to investigate the case, talk to the child, interview the parties, interview the collateral witnesses, review any documentation, and then provide an opinion and recommendation to the court as to what the court should do in the best interest of the minor child, whether the court should order a particular kind of therapy, whether the court should modify parenting time, whether the custody should be modified. And the GLs have tremendous power. The judges listen to them. The judges, in many instances, they act as mini judges. And with all this power comes responsibility as well. But unfortunately, what I have seen in case after case is that while the GL means well and their heart appears to be in the right place in most instances, they simply are not trained or experienced and skilled in the area of child alignment and alienation. And they seem to work or operate from their professional intuition. You'll rarely find a GL who has gone through training, for example, American Bar Association courses on alienation or AFCC courses on parental alienation, have read the material, have done research on it and whatnot. So they would jump in, they would talk to mom, they would talk to their dad, they would talk to the kid, and they would immediately shunt the matter off to therapy. Let's go to this doctor down the street. I know this person. He or she's a good therapist. Let's just calm down. All the motions suspended. No litigation. Just don't force parenting time. Listen to the voice of the child. Talk. Let the kid express their emotions. And if it's a case of alienation, that does not work. It doesn't work because a traditional therapist is usually trained to validate the patient or the client's emotions, beliefs, perceptions. They are not trained to confront these beliefs and perceptions if they are not based in reality. So let's take a scenario from our earlier example. The son doesn't want to see the mother, has been horribly rude and defiant to her. And the mother and the child go to, let's say, joint session with the traditional therapist. And the son starts spewing all these complaints about, you were never there when I was growing up. You are a bad mother. You are mean. You are an alcoholic, this and that. And the mother is just dumbfounded, aghast, angry perhaps as well, and starts rebutting the son's allegations. Let's look at these pictures. Let's look at that. Let's look at this and whatnot. And she usually is immediately shut down by the therapist. The therapist tells her to just stop right there. Don't contradict the child. Don't argue back. Just feel the pain. Look at his voice. Look at the tears. Show some empathy. Don't argue whether it's the right feeling or not, at the end of the day, it's the child's reality, and we have to honor that, and we have to respect the voice of the child. And it's like a Groundhog Day. It never moves on. The same complaints again and again. And the mother, the more it goes on, the targeted parent, the parent who is being rejected by her flesh and blood, gets anxious, gets agitated, gets frustrated, gets angry. And those reactions to alienation are then seen and conflated as causation. Look at how angry she gets in the session. Look at how frustrated she is in the courtroom. No wonder the child doesn't want to see her. Can you imagine what she must be like at home? And all these new realities come into play. And that's why in alienation cases, what's usually required is reunification, which is something very different than traditional therapy. And it usually involves a temporary separation between the child and the favored parent, so the child could experience the other parent and not just go with what the kid has been told all along.
You seem to suggest that the notion of parental alienation doesn't sit well with what you call traditional therapy. And I take it that there may be some controversy around the very concept of parental alienation. How well accepted is the notion of parental alienation, particularly among judges?
Well, I would beg to differ on that one with what you just characterized. I don't think there's any controversy whatsoever as to the idea or the phenomenon of parental alienation. There might be some disagreement amongst professionals, experts, as to whether there is something called parental alienation syndrome, or whether such a syndrome, if it exists, is covered in DSM-5, which is the Bible of psychiatric and mental health disorders. But as far as the phenomenon of parental alienation is concerned, overwhelming majority of family courts across the country have acknowledged that. The book that I earlier mentioned, Parental Alienation, Science and Law, which came out in 2020, contains a chapter in which there is a survey of these decisions all over America, California, New York, Wyoming, Washington, Florida, Illinois. And when you look at it from a bird's eye view, you see a remarkable agreement between family judges as to what this phenomenon is. Some courts have called this pathogenic parenting. Some have called it parental alienation. Some have called it counterproductive gatekeeping. But at the end of the day, the courts have focused on the behaviors of a parent. And sometimes trial judges say that out loud, particularly in rural counties, where you're trying to put an expert witness and show all this evidence, and these judges simply say, well, counsel, I don't care what you call it. I'm not going to get bogged down in some fine esoteric theories and labels and whatnot. I have been a trial judge for 40 years or 30 years, and I know when one parent badmouths the other parent in front of the child repeatedly, when one parent exposes the child to age-inappropriate information, when one parent interferes on the time of the other parent, that's just bad. It's not in the best interest of the child. You can call it alienation. You can call it interference. It's just old common sense to me. In fact, there was a decision not too long ago from Ontario Court of Appeals in Canada. And the Court of Appeals said that we are not even going to waste time on whether parental alienation is real or exists or not. We are, in fact, going to take judicial notice that the phenomenon of parental alienation exists. It's real, and where it does exist, it can do remarkable harm, substantial harm to the child in the relationship that the child has with the targeted parent. So in that situation, there is no controversy. And much of the controversy, so-called controversy, is a propaganda of misinformation. One of the disinformation out there, pieces of disinformation, is that the theory of parental alienation was just dreamt up by one psychiatrist, Richard Gardner, and it was simply done to protect abusive men and take custody away from women. And that's just pure nonsense. You know, when you look at these cases across the country, you find women as well as men who are targeted parents. In many, many, many cases, women are the victims of alienation. And there is significant amount of research published, peer-reviewed, by the way, which have shown as to how alienating behaviors are simply another kind of family violence. It's just domestic violence by another name. It has coercive control. It has power and control elements. It's emotional abuse. And the harm associated with alienation has been clearly documented.
Hey guys, I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, Fort's Legal Support. As busy litigators, there are never enough hours in the day. Why use a bunch of different legal support providers when there's one you can trust for all your needs? Need a process server in Chicago or a trial presentation specialist in LA? How about a court reporter in Dallas or a computer forensic expert in Atlanta? Forts Legal has you covered. I use Forts Legal in my litigation practice. They are responsive, economical, and ready to help every step of the way. By leveraging cutting-edge technology and best-of-class resources, Forts Legal is a trusted partner of solo attorneys and AmLaw 100 law firms alike. Contact Forts Legal today to learn how their team can assist your law practice. Visit them at fortslegal.com. That's FORTZLEGAL.com. Or call 844-730-4066. Now, I want to turn and talk about, you've touched on this already, but litigating these cases. You've talked about the science, you've talked about the research, you've talked about the impact on families, and you have touched on litigating these cases. What's the biggest obstacle to getting a good result for a targeted parent in an alienation case?
Well, it could be many things. Some of the common obstacles, if you can call it that, that I run into is simply too much time has passed by. By the time, sometimes when I get involved in a case, I have found that 2-3 years have gone by and the alienation has grown far worse. The parent who is complaining of being rejected has hardly seen the kid in the past 2 years. There's no contact whatsoever. And when we ask the lawyers involved or the GAL involved as to what has been going on, the answer is, well, we try to stay away from the courts and we try to not litigate the issue. It's not in the child's best interest to litigate this. We went to this therapist or that therapist and didn't work. And it's putting the cart before the horse. You know, it's like giving someone chemotherapy without the diagnosis of cancer. So you need to first identify the case and understand whether the case involves alienation or the case involves justified estrangement. Estrangement is very different from alienation. Estrangement involves cases where the parent has been rejected by the child, or the child is resisting having contact with the parent for legitimate, justifiable reasons. So let's say you have a father who is being rejected by the child. The child is resisting seeing the father. And there is evidence of alcohol abuse. There's evidence that the father has had DUI convictions. There is evidence that the father has behaved grossly inappropriately after being drunk. There's evidence of physical abuse. There's evidence of police interventions, child protective services investigations, substantiated findings, sometimes even prosecution and guilty verdicts or guilty pleas. In those situations, it is understandable that a child is afraid of that parent or doesn't want to see the parent without any safeguards. So you have to approach and distinguish those cases from alienation cases. And one of the ironies here is that now that the term parental alienation is in the mainstream and you find a lot of mention on social media, in books, movies, TV shows, everyone just uses the term in a very light manner. So any slight discord between the parties, any violations of the court orders or whatever is thrown into the court as evidence of alienation. My son doesn't want to do this because the mom's alienating. Or the dad doesn't want to do this because mom's alienating or whatnot. So you have to be careful. You don't want to desensitize your judge and lose credibility by just using that label or the term where the facts don't support it. So investigation at the earliest possible stage is important and you need to get to the bottom of it. And one way to do it would be to ask for a good evaluation, a good forensic evaluation, maybe a psychological evaluation involving all parties, kids, collateral witnesses, psychological testing, and the evaluator is asked to specifically opine on presence or absence of alienation slash estrangement dynamic. And then we go from there. And if there's disagreement, go through a trial, put your evidence in, and let the court make finding of fact. Otherwise, what typically undoes this case is motion filing. You often see these huge dockets of each side filing scores of motions. And these motions are not litigated. They're just posturing by each side. The lawyers meet on the day of the motion filing. The judge sometimes sends them off to the hallway to make deals and agreements. They make agreements, they come back, the agreements don't work out, more motions are filed. Nothing is ever decided. There is no judicial or clinical finding on the record as to why the child is resisting the parent. And that's what needs to happen at the earliest possible stage.
Well, yeah, in our system, trial is uniquely well-suited, I would argue. Finding facts about anything of significance.
Right. I think it's an absolute misconception that litigation doesn't help children, it's never in the child's best interest for the parents to litigate. I think if there are allegations that can be settled by fact-finding, it is important to litigate and as early as possible. Otherwise, you are going to have all these theories from each side, and the ghosts of these theories are going to haunt the case and the professions involved for months and for years.
Right. Perhaps never without resolution if it's never tried, right?
Right.
When you're litigating these cases, is it fair to say that the controversy always or often revolves around whether you have true alienation or what you characterize as estrangement, where a child rejects or is resistant to a parent for justifiable reasons?
Not always, but more often than not, I would say. I mean, there could be several battlegrounds. You know, for the first battle you may have to fight is, let's say, a motion for a Daubert hearing, a motion for a Fry hearing, depending on the jurisdiction you are in. The other side might just file a motion that the whole theory of parental alienation is bogus. It doesn't exist. It's not scientific. It should not pass the gatekeeping that is required by a trial judge. And you might have to put a whole dog and pony show based upon that and put an expert on, show the science, show the research, studies, whatnot. So that maybe it's a huge waste of time and expense, but sometimes you have to do it. Thankfully, more and more courts refuse to do it on the grounds that, no, we are not going to waste time and resources on whether alienation exists or not as a psychological phenomenon. That has been decided by many, many, many peer-reviewed articles and by many court decisions. We are going to focus on this case. And the sooner you get to that level, the better. In most instances, the fight or the litigation focuses on what's called factor three. So there are various ways you can prove alienation in a court of law. One of the common ways is the five-factor model. And the five-factor model focuses on the five factors. Factor one, you show that the child is rejecting a parent or resisting having a relationship with the parent. Factor two, you show that historically, the now-rejected parent has had a decent, normative, good, loving relationship with the child before separation or divorce, that they did have a good relationship. Factor three is absence of abuse or neglect or significantly deficient parenting. Factor four, alienating behaviors demonstrated by the favored parent. And factor five are signs of alienation present in the child. And in most cases, factor three becomes the hot battleground. And in alienation cases, any flaw in the rejected parent is simply exaggerated. So let's say you have a couple who is divorced, but when they were co-parenting, when they were together, they had different parenting styles. If you play to the stereotype, you can say that dad, for example, had an authoritative parenting style and the mom was a little bit more permissive. And together, they were good because it was yin and yang. Now that they are divorced, dad's authoritative style is seen as quote-unquote abusive. And mom being permissive is seen as understanding, empathetic, and whatnot. So if the dad is making rules that you must do your homework before you touch the media, or you're only allowed social media or video games particular times of the day or for so many hours, and you must go to church on Sundays or whatnot, I mean, that's his parenting style, and that he's entitled to have a parenting style. It's not abusive, but often those small flaws are presented as abusive parenting and are put forward as grounds for rejection by the child. And the research clearly shows, and this is where it gets counterintuitive, Max, the research shows us that truly abused children who have been physically removed from the parents and put into foster care, where they have been physically abused, horribly beaten, sexually abused, and worse, those children fight to have a relationship with the abusive parent. They make up excuses, they blame themselves, they will do anything in their power to maintain a connection with the abusive parent because the attachment is so strong. Whereas in an alienation situation, in severe alienation cases, the child has unequivocally rejected the parent. And when you push the child, when you push for the reasons, they are unable to come up with legitimate, justifiable reasons. And those, these are the hallmarks of these cases. And these kids come across as polarized. The professionals call it splitting. That means that they look at the world in black and white. The targeted parent, the rejected parent, is all black, all negative, has done nothing in their life, anything good, remotely good. And the favored parent is put on a pedestal and idealized and did nothing wrong ever in their life. And when these kids are asked by the evaluators, sometimes judges during the interviews, tell me, two things or three things good about your mom that you don't want to see. Not today, anytime. Did she do anything that was good to you? Did she ever bring a gift for you? Did she do anything that you really like or fondly remember? And they don't have a single instance. They just turn off. It's eyes glaze over. They don't want to talk about the parent. They just hang their head. And when you talk about the favorite parent, again, oh, he or she is perfect. Best dad ever, best mom ever, has done nothing wrong ever. So it's all the superlatives in those cases that come across.
Wow. Well, Ashish, this is all, it's really interesting, but it's also a really important topic, and I've appreciated your insights. I do want to ask you, for litigators who handle or deal with parental alienation cases and issues in their practice, can you give any advice for them?
I would advise them to learn more about this topic. Look at research articles, particularly peer-reviewed articles published by well-known professionals in the community. Some of the authors whom I like to read about and use their work in courts, and the judges have cited that as well. And look at the court findings. I found that, you know, we lawyers tend to think somewhat in parochial terms, and that's how we are trained. So if I'm in Michigan, I would look at Michigan Court of Appeals and Michigan Court's decisions, particularly published ones, and I tend to ignore, for example, Indiana or California or New York. And thinking goes that, well, my judge in so-and-so county is not really going to care about what New York says on this issue. And that's not accurate. I have never found a judge to say no when I put the situation in the following terms. And I argue that, you know, Your Honor, you're absolutely right. You being in California, New York court's decision is not binding on you. But here's this case where this trial judge in New York was wrestling with a similar set of facts that you are wrestling with. The kids are of similar age. The allegations were very similar. This judge spent an enormous amount of time and made an effort to go through a trial and made distinguished finding of facts, detailed finding of facts. You can take it for whatever you will. You can give whatever weight you think it deserves. It might help you, it might not. But what's the harm in looking at it? And when you put it in that way, they don't shy away from that. And I think the lawyers need to broaden their horizons. They need to read more about this theory. They need to read about the peer-reviewed research. They need to read some really foundational books on this topic. And they also need to understand that, yes, there are instances where the theory of alienation has been misused in courts. You know, similar to domestic violence. I mean, there are false allegations of domestic violence. There are false allegations of sex abuse. And in the same way, sometimes a parent or a litigant will make false allegations of parental alienation. But that doesn't mean that the science underlying the theory is faulty. That doesn't mean that we throw out the baby with the bathwater. That doesn't mean that we call the theory of alienation bogus. At the end of the day, facts is what supports a theory. You can't litigate a theory in search of facts. You need to have facts first and then figure out whether it's alienation, estrangement, or something else.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful advice. Really interesting and important topic. I thank you for being with us today, Ashish. Before we close, can you tell our listeners where they can find you?
Well, they can find me through my website, which is www.joshi attorneys.com. They can also find me on Facebook and LinkedIn. I often post literature, articles, write on social media platforms. And if they need to send me an email, my email address is a.joshi@joshiattorneys.com.
Well, thank you again for sharing your insights on the litigation war room.
Thank you, Max. It was a pleasure to be here with you.
Hi, Powell. It's great to see you. Excited to have you as a speaker and moderator at the upcoming Business Law Symposium. I think you need no introduction to listeners in Michigan and the Detroit area, but why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and about your law firm and your law practice?
Well, in 1992, I gave up my partnership at the Honigman firm, which is a great firm, and decided to be an entrepreneur and build my firm from scratch. I sold my house. I sold my car. I raised $35,000 and lived off my wife's $20,000 therapist salary. One area of interest I always had was shareholder litigation and shareholder oppression cases, securities fraud cases, shareholder class actions. And that's been a cornerstone of my firm for 30 years. And we now have 35 lawyers, and a big part of our firm is shareholder litigation.
We're excited to hear you at the symposium, and you're actually going to be participating in two sessions, one as a moderator and the other as a speaker. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about what to expect from your sessions at the symposium?
Well, first, I just want to give some kudos to Mark Rossman, who put this together. And he does a fabulous job with this symposium. He always gets a great roster of people, interesting topics, and it's extraordinarily well run. And so I'm very pleased that Mark invited me to participate again. I'm going to be talking about entrepreneurial strategies for the pandemic, law firm management during the pandemic. And one of my main themes, Max, is when the pandemic hit, there was tremendous uncertainty. And I always believe in the long game. So the first thing that I did was have a Zoom call with everybody in the firm and said, obviously, there's a worldwide crisis. I got your back. No one is going to be laid off because of the pandemic. No one is going to have their salary cut. I'm going to go to zero until we get to the other side. But everybody else is going to be just fine, and I'm going to do great, too. And that inspired confidence, and all the people who work at our firm took a lot of pressure off. And lo and behold, a year later, I was pleased to report to everybody in the firm that we were stronger today than we were before the pandemic started. So I think a big part of law firm management and entrepreneurial strategies for the pandemic is to invest in the resources that you have and to provide them with tremendous security. And that's exactly what I did. We also believe that anytime there's dislocation or crisis, there's opportunity. And there's no question that the type of crisis that we had has led to more shareholder disputes, has led to more dislocation, and therefore more shareholder litigation. And for lawyers, that obviously creates opportunity. I'm also going to talk about innovations that we came up with because of the pandemic. I'll just give you one teaser now, Max. And that teaser is, I thought Zoom hearings were just awful. Lawyers sitting down, shuffling through papers, not effective, too informal. So we built a virtual courtroom. so that we stand, we have a camera at eye level and a gigantic screen, so that when I make an oral argument, I can have my speaker notes that only I can see, not the judge or the other side, on the screen, eye level with the court. So I can cite cases, I can recite arguments as if they're memorized off the top of my head with nobody realizing that I'm looking at my own notes. So in some ways, we figured out a way to make oral arguments more effective than they are when you're actually in court, because now you can be looking at your own notes without looking down. And we found that to be very effective. So that's one of the entrepreneurial strategies that we employed to give our clients an advantage over our opponents, notwithstanding the limitations of the pandemic where we couldn't actually go into court.
Those both sound like fabulous topics. Those were terrific previews. I, for one, can't wait to hear your other remarks at the upcoming symposium. So we're looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Powell.
Thank you very much, Max.
You have been listening to The Litigation War Room with litigation attorney Maxwell Goss. Maxwell Goss represents clients in intellectual property and business cases in Michigan and around the country, bringing forceful advocacy and creative solutions to every case he handles. For show notes and more episodes, please visit us at thelitigationwarroom.com. That's thelitigationwarroom.com. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to The Litigation War Room, and please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. The Litigation War Room, including the podcast and all website content and social media on all platforms, is for informational and entertainment purposes only. This podcast does not provide legal advice and does not give rise to an attorney-client relationship under any circumstance. All views, opinions, and statements expressed by guests are those of the guests making them, and not those of the Litigation War Room.